This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014. We're starting a new section. I don't know if we want to call this part of the current Jewish question series or separate. Something that I've wanted to do for a while, I've held off for a bit, called the Kosher Kitchen Crash Course. And this requires a bunch of disclaimers. First off, I might repeat questions because I decided to mic myself up for this one because I might move around a bit with some visual aids. Anyway, the thing is this. When I learned Yoredeya, which is one of the sections of the Shulchan Aruch, when it actually has a whole bunch of things in there, when people say, I learned Yoredeya, they're referring specifically to the laws of Kashrut. Unfortunately, virtually no one, unless you're in rabbinical school, studies the laws of Kashrut, which is odd given how much of a fundamental role it plays in living a Jewish life. In fact, one of the reasons why I went to rabbinical school initially was all the things that you learn in rabbinical school are things you need to know to be a frum Jew anyway, or at least on the YU curriculum at least. I can't speak to... I know someone did smicha, and I'm just mentioning this one, and he said that part of his curriculum was Hilchot Apikoris, the laws of heretics. Some place in Israel, it was not a Rabbanut exam, but the point is, Kashrut is kind of essential, and what we do more often as a community here is what Chaim Soloveitchik, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik would call mimetic culture. You see what your parents did, and you just copy however it was that you were raised. Why? You don't know. Right? But even though you don't really know it, people who have no formal training are completely fine telling someone else, you just trafed up your kitchen. Right? This is also, you know, in addition to just being very important, it's also somewhat of a challenging class to give. So in rabbinical school, we spend like a full year doing this, like full time. Like this was, it's a pretty major, you know, area that we covered. And I'm going to try to distill it into like 2 or 3 weeks. With that in mind, one, this is only a crash course. It's not going to get people to like Paskin, you know, this is good, this is bad. Certainly not trafe up someone else's kitchen. The intent is you'll have a better idea of what questions to ask. And when someone gives you an answer, it'll be, you'll have at least a better idea of what they're talking about. Or if you want to ask a follow-up question, you'll understand where the person is coming from. All right. So it's more a matter of trying to make a bunch of the details of Kashrut make sense. And the way that I want to set this up is more from a theory based first, and then we'll, you know, give some practical examples. I've also focused specifically on the kosher kitchen part, in the sense that I wanted to pick things that are going to be the most common that people deal with. When we get to Yoredeya, it goes through so many different scenarios. Most often, they're never going to come up for people. It might, but you know, or certain things might apply to an industrial complex than it, or industrial food packaging or, you know, making place as opposed to your own home. And that's another very important distinction there, too. A friend of mine who worked for the Orthodox Union was telling me once about why the OU's policies officially might be stricter than what the Shulchan Aruch might actually dictate. And one reason he gave was simply, most of the people who work machines at food manufacturing factories don't know Jewish law at all. Odds are they're not even Jewish. So sometimes as a matter of policy for how you set, like for degrees of either universalism, like across the board for all your factories, to make sure that you don't have every individual making up their own minds, especially when they don't know what they're doing, for practical policy reasons, sometimes it pays to be stricter. And that gets to another final, I guess the final point before we get here. The more detailed we get, the more disputes we're going to find. And like we are with, like I'm doing, I guess, with the Shabbat class, I'm going to try to avoid a lot of them. Because the goal is to understand the basics of what's behind, as opposed to me just poskening. Because especially with matters from Kashrut, and we'll see, you know, certainly next week, there are certain opinions that, even though, you know, you consider them to be, you know, legitimate opinions, like Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, no one considers him to be like a wacky left winger, but some of his Piskei Halacha are not followed by many Jews. And even if they may make sense, the question is, well, why not? And what does that mean for halachic normativity? I'm going to skip a bunch of that, or at least you'll know when I'll say, well, he says this and he says that, and try to figure out why. In general, it's usually easier to be strict, but there's also, I think, an important reason to understand why is someone strict, where is this coming from, on what point are they being strict, and leave it up to local rabbis to do their own thing. So if at any point I say something and you feel, hey, I learned this differently, the answer is you probably did. Because often they'll just say, well, here's what we do. And unfortunately, with things like Kashrut, like many other areas of Jewish law, people will cite people selectively. There's no source that anyone goes full on out. So hopefully, at least after today, we're going to discuss some theory and definitions. We'll understand when we actually get to the practical side of things. Like, why does this work the way that it does? And you'll see today, like, there's an important thing to come, a term that we use sometimes called halachic physics, by which I mean there are certain assumptions Jewish law makes that we'll have to take as givens. I included in here a few actual primary sources. I think two sources from the Talmud, three sources from the Talmud, one source from Rambam, just as a matter of summary. They spend a lot more time going into a whole lot more detail with this. I wanted to just pick a few examples. By no means is this intended to be comprehensive. When we get to the definitions, these are things that you'll find generally little disagreement on. You'll find more disagreement over how do we apply them. All right. So the first term that we need to the first term we need to define is something called a ta'arovet, which is a mixture. Does the root ring a bell? I know I've given this analogy several times here. What is the root of ta'arovet? Hebrew works on a three-letter root system. Yes, which means ayin resh bet. Well, Erev, very good. That's one of the great examples I give. It's a mixture of day and night, right? Because you've got Yom, you've got Laila, day and night, and in the middle you have Erev, which is a mixture of both. You might remember we gave a class on Eruv. Mm-hmm. What is an Eruv? It's a mixture of a bunch of private domains into one big domain. So what is a mixture? The absolute simplest, most abstract definition of a mixture. What do you think, Jamie?
A lot of component parts.
Yeah, or even just not a lot of component parts. Something and something else.
Yeah.
That's a mixture, right? Now, there has to be something, and there are actually a few different types of mixtures here. Hello, pass that down. You know, there has to be something with these entities, or something and something else, that makes it somewhat differentiated. Otherwise, you just have a whole lot of the same thing. Anyone here a fan of Mitch Hedberg? Comedian?
We know him, yeah.
All right, so he's got a line about rice is a perfect food because it's what you want to eat when you want 2,000 of something.
Right.
All right? That's when everything is the exact, you know, identical. There has to be something about these items that would classify them as different. All right? So one example is in Hebrew, min bimino, where two types of things, a thing and its type, they're pretty much the exact same thing, but there could be some other difference about them. So, here's for example, we've got two par of Sharpies, right? They're green, right? Green means par. So we have two par of Sharpies. So let's say one is truma and the other isn't. One is a type of food that's specifically, you know, for a Kohen and the other isn't. You put them in your little crock pot here, you've got yourself a mixture of min bimino, a thing and its type, but one thing you're not allowed to eat. Another type of mixture is dry and liquid, right? So you can understand, like, there could be different halachic implications for that, right? Dropping in something solid into something liquid, yes, on one hand you have a mixture, on the other hand, it's, you know, you could take out, oh, let's even take it a step further. You've got two dry things here. You've got two par of Sharpies, right, that are dry. Let's say, well, you've got something in there that shouldn't be there. You've got one very easy solution, right, which is you can take it out. Well, that's if you know which one is which. If I've got, you know, two ones that are clearly different, right, they just happen to be in a bowl, it's very easy to pick out the ones where they're like, let's say you've got a jar full of M&Ms, right? So some, like, let's say, like, all of the brown ones are fine and all of the red ones are truma, and you know that for a fact, well, then you just pull out all the red ones. Mm-hmm. And you can actually find on YouTube, there have been people who have made M&M selector thingies based on, like, light sensors. And, you know, like, you dump in coins and, like, it organizes that. You dump in M&Ms, it will actually organize you stacks by color.
So good service to society.
Exactly. Right? But if you have dry and liquid, well, it depends, like, how much of the dry stuff can, you know, get absorbed by the liquid. Right? Or you can have dry and liquid, or you can have two things that are dry, or you mix two liquids together. You mix two liquids together, well, you can't just split those apart, barring the whole oil and water thing, but even that gets a little bit tricky, man. The ones that are most, I mean, those are types of mixtures in terms of the substance of what it is that you're mixing. And there are special Jewish laws regarding, you know, lach belach, you know, two liquids together, min bimino. We're going to skip most of those. Just assume right now those are types of mixtures. The ones that we kind of deal with the most, though, when we're talking about kosher kitchen issues, is kosher and non-kosher food, which for a general thing here, it's a mixture of permitted and forbidden food. By, you know, forbidden, permitted and forbidden, this actually, when it comes to Jewish law, runs a gamut of a whole bunch of things. Food, right, when we think of kosher, it's almost a general thing of food that you're allowed to eat or not. But there are a whole bunch of reasons why you wouldn't be allowed to eat certain food. Right? Any thoughts on why?
Why you wouldn't be allowed to eat certain foods.
Why would certain foods not be allowed to be eaten? So one would be it is not kasher, right? So let's say it's meat from an animal that wasn't slaughtered properly, or from one of the animals that the Torah says don't do it. That is one type of food that you're not allowed to eat. If you're not a priest, you're not allowed to eat truma. Right? Even though the animal might have been shafted completely okay, a non-Kohen is not allowed to eat truma. If food was used for our avodah zarah, right? For idolatry, you wouldn't be allowed to eat that either. All right? I think a good example, Passover, right? There is food that we say is kasher lePesach, food that is permitted to be eaten on Pesach, but can't, right? So it's kosher just for this particular week, you're not allowed to eat it. Mm-hmm. All right? So when I use the forbidden, I mean, there are also separate laws regarding Pesach, although sometimes there are overlaps. So it's important to keep in mind that there are a whole lot of reasons why you wouldn't be allowed to eat a certain piece of food. They may not all be relevant to, you know, daily life, because I don't know how many people here have, you know, food used for idolatry in their house. But, you know, things like, you know, and also if you're in Israel, like truma's a much bigger deal because it's dependent on being in the land of Israel. But it's something to keep in mind, all right, just the varied behind it. And the last mixture that's very unusual is one you're probably all familiar with, which is the mixture of meat and dairy. And the reason why that's unusual is, it's a good thing I have a fear, I can change my own typos here, is that the ingredients themselves of meat and dairy are fine separately. Meaning, assuming you've got meat that was slaughtered correctly, and you've got dairy that there's no problem with it too, right? Jewish-owned dairy farm. Independently, the foods are fine. But it's when you put those two together, it's the specific mixture of both that is problematic. So as opposed to, say, a piece of non-kosher meat falls in your cholent, well, that's a mixture of, well, something shouldn't be there, and it's sort of wrong in its own right, or by wrong I mean bad in its own right, in terms of this whole mixture. Whereas opposed to meat and dairy, it's like they're fine separately. Once you put them together, whoa, you got a problem. All right? So those are different types of mixtures, and they can all have their separate laws. All right? Now, And a very important concept that comes up, and this has to be stressed because this, I think, really forms the foundation of most of the laws of kashrut, is the topic of ta'am, which means taste. Anyone hear that term before? Ta'am meaning taste? You might find ta'am, you like good taste. All right, fine. Why is this important? First, a principle in Hebrew called ta'am ki'ikar. If the residual taste, even the residual taste of a food is equivalent to the substance of the food being in the mixture, regardless of the proportions. So, plain English. Let's say you've got a piece of non-kosher meat there, right? You take out the meat. But anyone who's cooked knows that meat can impart flavor. One food can impart some of its flavor onto the entire mixture. This principle of ta'am ki'ikar, of that taste is equivalent to the whole thing, really defines a whole lot of the other halachot that come. And that's why, like, when I was learning it in, you know, smicha, I was like, it would be a lot easier, for me at least, the way I learned stuff. You start here, and then you explain why everything else, you know, works. Ta'am ki'ikar, again, means residual taste of something is as if it, that whole thing is there itself. So even if you scooped out that piece of non-kosher meat, as long as you can still taste that non-kosher meat in that mixture, it's still there, no matter what. And in Hebrew, the idiom for giving over a taste or imparting that flavor is called notein ta'am. Right, important Hebrew phrase here. It gives over its flavor, gives over its taste. Right? Now, one way something gives over its taste is simply you drop it in the food, and through the natural cooking process, stuff spreads around. Right? Certain things that are juicier, right, might give off more of a taste, like than solids, and those also have some halachic implications. Right? Another important phrase here is kibola'o kach polito. This means, as taste is absorbed, so it is exuded. And this is a principle that comes up regarding things like pots or other vessels. So anyone here ever wonder, how is it possible that you have a dairy pan or a meat pot? What's meat about it? Yeah, so you cook meat in there. Why does that make it meat? So what do you think?
It's absorbed.
The taste of whatever you cooked in there was absorbed by the walls. So let's say I've got, this is a bad example because this crock pot is part, but let's say this was a Fleischer crock pot. All right? So it means I cooked meat in this crock pot. That's how it became Fleischer. How? Because the meat flavor that I cooked, and when I personally cook crock pot, it cooked chulent, it's really Fleischer because I don't do water, I do beef broth. Right, so that whole liquid, that's all meat there. So the taste of that gets absorbed in the walls of the vessel, of the crock pot. Right? Now, kibola'o kach polito really means the way it comes is the way it goes. So just as flavor can be absorbed by the walls of the vessel, so too it can impart that flavor onto things in which it is being cooked. All right? Does that make relative sense? And I'm making that term, you know, right? If we can get past the point that the fact that food imparts flavor, I think we can all agree on. All right? No arguments there. Fine. But the fact that the flavor can be absorbed by the walls of a vessel sometimes can be a little bit hard to get your, you know, wrap your head around.
It's the fat or the juice from the food that's absorbed rather than the flavor.
Well, yes, but for halachic purposes, we're focusing on the ta'am. We're focusing on the flavor or the taste, again, because of that principle, ta'am ki'ikar. Because if you have a bit of that taste, it's as if that whole thing is there. All right? Are we okay so far? Jamie, read. This is a Mishnah in Avodah Zarah 5:2.
Sure. If an Israelite purchases cooking utensils from a heathen, those which are customarily cleansed by immersion, he must immerse. By scalding, he must scald. By making white hot in the fire, he must make white hot in the fire. A spit and grill must be made white hot.
So this is the principle of the way it comes is the way it goes in action. In plain English, the way that vessels absorb taste is through some sort of heat. All right, so let's talk about heat. There are also other exceptions with, like, a davar harif or certain type of spicy foods. Putting that aside, the main rule we're going to focus on here right now is matters of heat, that heat somehow affects this transference. There are really two types of heat that we talk about in terms of kashrut: dry heat and wet heat. Dry heat would be the equivalent of a putting something on a spit. You all know what a spit is? If you don't, the way you see it today, really, is if you go to see shawarma, right? The way that they cook shawarma is they put a whole slab of meat directly onto a metal rod, and they spin it around, and it's getting cooked from the sides. Mm-hmm. All right? So that meat is imparting its flavor onto that pole through the means of direct heat, right? Mm-hmm. That would be what you would call dry heat. Wet heat would be things like boiling, right? So you cook a chilant in a crock pot, you need to have some liquid there, otherwise you're burning your food. That would be wet heat. What
isn't
is it?
Isn't everything wet heat, that we, like what we would cook in our houses?
You could do a regular roast.
But don't you mean like oil?
Oil is a great exception there, and that you have a bit of a dispute over whether or not oil is considered wet or dry. You'll have one opinion, I don't know what that was from, you'll have one opinion that says it's not our oven in the shul, I can promise you that. So there is one opinion that says that since oil is a liquid, we treat it as a liquid. So if you fry stuff in a frying pan, the way that you would get the stuff out of it would be through liquid, or there's another opinion which states that since the oil is a heating agent, it's considered as one. Right? My own tendency is to think that oil is still liquid, right? And like dry is dry, but like something directly on a spit, you don't have oil there, or you don't really grease it up. Although, I mean, you got fat on the top. Whatever, that's a separate
issue.
There are people who do. Let's say you're doing hamburgers on a grill.
Oh, yeah, I guess grilling.
Right? Grilling is, you know, there's nothing else there. So you could do that today, and people still do, have direct meat directly on something metal that's heated just through a direct heat source, as opposed to boiling something. So what that means is, the way it comes is the way it goes. If something absorbed the heat through direct dry heat, well then, the way that you get it out is through direct dry application of heat.
What about a dishwasher?
That's next week, and we'll
but not even koshering a dishwasher.
Oh, just next week, okay. And we'll get in a lot. Well, I'll get
dry
in a lot.
Dry heat.
It, well, no, because it shoots in water jets.
No, after to dry it.
Yeah, we'll do dishwashers next week. Yeah.
Okay.
So, if you want to make it, let's say you want to make a pan kosher, right? Or let's say you just use the pan for direct frying without oil. You never like add it in anything for whatever reason.
Well,
what? Exactly. Why? Because you're using the application of direct heat. In Hebrew, the word is called libun, from the root being lavan, where you literally make it white hot, right? And you're effectively like burning the thing out of it, burning whatever taste is out of it. Mm-hmm. All right? And then the other way is with wet heat is hagala. Well, better, sorry. Where you basically just, you boil water and you drop the vessel such that it is fully immersed and fully covered by the water. That's simple. All right. Next week we'll get to exceptions in terms of like utensils and like we'll deal with more of the exceptions about how it works, right? But at least understand that's how you kosher something. Why does that work again? Because the vessel absorbed the taste of whatever was cooked. However it was absorbed is how it goes out. Bam. There you go. Again, so far, you all with me here? Mm-hmm. Makes relative sense about how koshering something works?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, this is why I wanted to give it this way, because like usually it's just, well, this and then that. Like, there's actually a logic to this. If you can accept the premise of flavor can get absorbed, this stuff really does make sense, and it can really follow a logical progression.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Any questions so far?
If it's a dish that you heat up through either method.
Hmm?
So you might heat the crock pot up on the stove, or you might reheat it in the oven.
What do you mean?
necessarily that no, that's both dry. If you heat a vessel with both wet and hot,
then it goes by the stricter one. Meaning, the direct dry heat is considered the highest level. But if something was absorbed, if you had like a metal pot that you only used to boil things, if you did libun on it, it would be fine. So that would be the highest level, right, that you would have. But so technically, if it's something that only required Haggala, then you could do libun on it. Not everyone has a blowtorch, right? Not everyone like wants to go through that. Yeah, well, it's something that I've got to say Chabad does a wonderful job with come Pesach time. You can find some koshering stations. Well, they will take care of everything for you. They're also known for going into places and koshering kitchens. There you go. So it's a service that they provide that you know, can be really good. We'll talk a little bit more in detail like next week when we can get to specifics. But it's good to put in a plug there. So those are the basics. Now we get to some very important exceptions to this whole absorption rule. First one that many of you are probably familiar with is something called batel b'shishim, which means it's nullified 1/60th, where if the taste of a food cannot be discerned, we assume it has been sufficiently diluted. Sam, can you read, this is Gemara in Chulin 97a and b. This is part of a chapter that discusses most of the details of the laws of kashrut. Yeah, so read that, please.
Rava also said, in certain cases, the rabbis rule that the test whether or not it imparts a flavor applies. And in other cases, the rabbis ruled that one may rely upon a Gentile cook. We rely upon the opinion of a Gentile cook. Where substances of like kind were mixed together, in which case it is impossible to discern whether one imparts a flavor to the other, or where substances of different kinds, one of which was forbidden, were mixed together, and no Gentile cook is available, then the test is 60/1.
So this is the basis for, again, like, here's the source for it. Let's talk this out. So we mentioned before, right, this whole thing is based on ta'am ki'ikar. If you can taste it, it's there, and it's considered as if the whole thing has it. Let's say a piece of non-kosher meat fell into something. How do you know it's there? If it's all dependent on taste, someone's got to taste it. But if you can taste it, then it means you ate non-kosher. Aha! Got the problem?
Mm-hmm.
Right? How are you supposed to taste whether or not it's kosher or not without actually tasting something non-kosher?
Mm-hmm.
So solution one is simply, well, get a non-Jew to do it. Right? Because a non-Jew has no rules of kashrut.
Mm-hmm.
And there are discussions that Shulchan Aruch goes into about situations that this happens. For example, if you have like a professional, you know, cook or taste tester who does this, that you know that they're not going to lie. Or if you have something like, you know, Mesiach Lefi Tumo, someone who volunteers the information and literally means he tells you out of innocence or out of simplicity, and he doesn't think that you're relying on his testimony, whatever. Those are all discussions that you get to in Shulchan Aruch. Point is here, option one, if you know that the thing, that it's something that's possible to be discerned, right? If the taste is there, you get a non-Jew to taste it. Let's say you're like making a stew and somehow non-kosher curry powder fell in there, right? I'm only using that because I don't know, right? Again, by non-kosher, I'm using it in the broadest possible sense, right? Not just, oh, what could be non-kosher about curry powder? That's why we did all that stuff at the beginning.
Dairy or something.
I don't know, right? Dairy curry powder. It could happen, right? So how do you know if it's there? How do you know if it's there? So that's something I pick out because it's a spice that odds are someone could probably, you know, notice the difference. So you get a professional taste tester to do that. Otherwise, right, the principle is if, you know, let's say it's a piece of meat in a crock pot. It's the same, let's say it's beef, right? It's all the same type of beef. I know that there's some, you know, really good, you know, anyone here watch any of those food reality shows like Top Chef or whatnot? Right. So people can apparently, you know, tell what the different types of meats are. I think Gordon Ramsay has that as one of his tests on Hell's Kitchen, of like, you know, having people, can you actually identify the types of meats that you're eating and all that sort of thing, right? Then, yeah, people say, like, this is gamey. I have no idea what gamey means. But the point is, like, let's say a piece of non-kosher beef falls into your beef cholent, right? If it was another type of meat, or maybe chicken, you might be able, you know, to like tell, oh yeah, this tastes like chicken, not like, if it, well, bad example. But let's say it's all the same type of food. You don't know whether or not, you know, so here, batel b'shishim. Based on the Talmudic rule, if having a professional taste tester isn't going to help, you can assume batel b'shishim. If the quantity of everything else that's kosher to eat outnumbers it 60 to 1, it's okay. Caveat, though, if you could still taste it, it's still halachically there. Meaning the batel b'shishim can work as an assumption, right? But let's say you're very sensitive to something, like...
Curry powder.
Let's say it would be curry powder, yeah. Right? Or you've got some crazy strong curry powder, or what's a good example? The insane chili pepper, mm-hmm. Right? There's actually a heat index of like how spicy a food is. So let's say that, you know, might fall in there, right? So you can't, you know, it's hard to like say, but like let's say, well, that could already be something where, well, let's say it's even 1 in 1,000, for example. Right, you still might taste that, mm-hmm. Right? Because it's so sharp and it's so at odds with everything else. Yeah. This rule about batel b'shishim is not going to be universal just on that alone. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of other halachot behind that too, but keep in mind that principle of ta'am ki'ikar, of the taste being equal to that thing, will override batel b'shishim. It will override being nullified 1 in 60. So, if there's ever like a mess up there, try not to do it with anything that's too identifiable to the palate. Here's another important rule that comes up with the laws of kashrut. You might have heard this called not bar not. Anyone hear about that? Mm-hmm. So not bar not is really an acronym, or partial acronym. The nun tet stands for no tain ta'am. So spread all out, like when you expand it, not bar not means no tain ta'am bar no tain ta'am, which is a second degree of taste transference. Explain in plain English. I've got my Fleischik Expo marker in the crock pot. I cook a cholent. The meat gets absorbed into the walls. That is what we call no tain ta'am. That's when A gives it to B. No tain ta'am bar no tain ta'am is the second degree removed. So if I'm cooking my parv in this pot, then the ta'am that's here would go into here, into the new thing that's being cooked. It's no, well, we haven't gotten there yet, right? Before we start talking about psak, first understand the concept. No tain ta'am is one, from here to here. Bar no tain ta'am is from here, back out to here. Because when I'm cooking food in the crock pot, I'm cooking it in the same way that it absorbed. I'm boiling sort of a stew in there, right? So the way it got in is the way it goes out. It is going to be polite. It will exude the flavor into this guy. But it's important to keep in mind, it's a derivative flavor, right? When this gets absorbed here, right, the meat gets absorbed the first time, you have actual meat that's being absorbed here. Is any actual meat being absorbed? Maybe on a molecular level, but like, come on, mm-hmm. Right? Not really. It's the taste that we're concerned about that's absorbed, right? So what comes out of here isn't the actual meat, it's the taste of the meat, which, as we said, ta'am ki ikar, but that does have halachic ramifications. Can you do the Gemara in Chulin 111b? Let's do the Gemara first and then get to the question, because the Gemara might answer it.
If hot fish was served on meat, Rav says, it is forbidden to eat it with milk sauce. Samuel says, it is permitted to eat it with milk sauce. Rav says, it is forbidden because it imparted a flavor to it. Samuel says, it is permitted because it imparted a flavor indirectly.
Right, so here we've got, so you've got a dispute between Rav and Shmuel about serving hot fish on a meat plate. Right, so are you allowed to eat that fish, which is parv, with dairy? So Shmuel says yes. Rav says no. So there's actually a dispute in the Talmud here about whether or not it's considered one, like, once removed, or is it twice removed? According to the opinion of Shmuel, because it's notein ta'am bar notein ta'am, it's 1 degree removed, it doesn't actually impart the flavor over. So, plain English here, this means if you have a piece of fish, you cook it in a meat, in a pan that was previously used for meat, but with no other meat in there now, the meat that is in the pan, the taste, right, that might get into the fish. According to Shmuel, that's notein ta'am bar notein ta'am. It's 1 degree removed, which means it's permissible to eat with something dairy. This is the source of the whole dairy equipment thing, where Shulchan Aruch paskins straight like Shmuel. The Ramat is stringent, by which I mean he acknowledges that it is a chumrah. He doesn't say it's a matter of law, but a stringency not to eat that piece of fish with meat at the exact same time. All right. Now, does that make the meat? Does that make the fish fleshik? According to Shmuel, no. But it can still, might still cause problems. For example,
what dish would you eat in that?
Fish and cheese? I don't know.
So you're saying you could eat it?
Or even if it's not directly cheese, let's say you want to have dairy in a, you know, fish meal, right? Are you fleshig now after you eat that fish?
No, I'm just saying, what plate would you put it on?
Paper.
I like the way you think. But you have to realize that that is, right, only one type of mixture. Where you may still run into trouble is you have your fleshik crock pot. Let's say you cook something milchik in there. So what happens? This crock pot absorbed the taste of meat. When I cook my milchik in here, that residual taste of the meat goes into the milk mixture. If it was parav, it might not be enough to turn what's parav fleshik. But if it's milchik, once you have that interaction between the milchik and the fleshik, between the meat and the dairy, as we said earlier, that very mixture is what is problematic. Mm-hmm. All right? So it's an important rule to know that on one hand you can have certain leniencies with notein ta'am bar notein ta'am, this second degree transference, but it's not going to apply to everything, or I shouldn't say that, it might not apply to everything. In particular, when you have that mixture of meat and milk, once any bit of that meat comes out into your milk dish, you got yourself a problem. Whereas it might be minuscule enough not to make something like fish fleshik, because it's that second degree removed. Because as long as fish is, as long as the milk is being cooked in a fleshik crock pot, it's not even notein ta'am bar notein ta'am. You might even argue that it still could be that residual stuff from that first one that's now getting all mixed together. All right? Excellent. Another one that's going to come up is something called notein ta'am lifgam, something that gives over a transfer of flavors undesirable, right? We didn't get to your question.
What about the one we did before, batel b'shushim?
Mm-hmm.
So if you cook meat in that crock pot and now you want to cook something else, let's say it's parv in it, there's no meat actually in it, so that you taste it, you're not going to taste the meat.
It's a beautiful question. I love that question. Yeah, that's one of those detailed questions, so there are different ways of approaching how to do that. And a lot of it's going to come down to volume. Meaning, like, how to put this? You can either say that it absorbed whatever volume of the meat that was in there and sort of dispersed that out amongst the entire walls. Let's say you've got like a giant 6-quart pot and you're only cooking like a small amount of like dairy in there. Right, so if you say that the meat only, that the walls only absorbed the non-kosher part there, well, then that's going to be dissipated amongst the entire walls. But if you're going to say that, you know, it doesn't matter as long as there was something non-kosher there, we assume that it spreads out to the entirety of the walls, then you would have to redo your calculation in terms of how much of the volume that you're cooking as compared to the volume in the walls of the pot itself. You'll notice I did not give you a straight answer there intentionally, but those would be some of the ways that you would tackle that question. All right? Okay. Calculating the amount that you're cooking vis-a-vis the walls on the side in terms of how much might also get out there. And there are also other rules about batel bishish, and some people will say that you should not rely on that, like l'chatchila, initially, but rather if you happen to have cooked in, you know, this particular way, then you can rely on it. A whole bunch of other details that might come up, but it's a wonderful question.
Okay. And the idea of a vessel being either having meat or milk cooked into it is not time limited. So if there's a dish you use,
that's our next source. Actually, that gets into that. But okay. Brilliant, Risa, could you do this for us? This is Rambam, Laws of Forbidden Foods, Ma'achalot Asurot 17:2. Again, this is picking a Rambam because he will summarize where the Gemaras that he relies on are based on part of a dialectic, which going through in detail inside get more complicated. I like quoting Gemaras when they're simple and straightforward for stuff like this. Rambam here provides a useful summary. All right. Again, not that everyone agrees with it, but know at least this is Rambam.
The Torah only forbade vessels which had been used during the previous day, since the fats which were absorbed by the vessel have not gone bad yet. From rabbinic law, one cannot use these vessels, a clay vessel which was used for non-kosher food at all. Therefore, we do not take old clay vessels from non-Jews who use them with heated food, such as pots or plates, ever. And even if it was filled with metal, if you took and cooked with them on the second day and on, the cooked food is permitted.
Ah, so here's an interesting principle here. One, this is noten ta'am lifgam in action. And two, introduces the concept of bein yomo, or bat yoma, as Rambam writes here in the feminine. What this means is this. When a taste has been absorbed by a vessel, within 24 hours, meaning within the same day that you've used it, it is considered whatever flavor it then imparts is going to be favorable or good. After that 24-hour period, it is considered noten ta'am lifgam. Think of it this way. The taste that's been absorbed by a pot spoils in a day. So that gets to your time limit thing. The reason why it serves as a time limit, again, is after that time, the halachic assumption is noten ta'am lifgam. Anything it imparts afterwards is a negative ta'am, would make your food worse. And according to Maimonides, it seems to be permissible. Right? And that's a very interesting halacha that he ends off with here, which you could probably guess not everyone agrees with. His statement is, biblically, there's no problem with it. There's a rabbinic decree against using these particular vessels. But according to Rambam, if you had a non-kosher pan, the reason why I put in the brackets here a clay vessel used for non-kosher food, like cooked with non-kosher food, was in Law 17:1 that he's referring to. But he said, even if you cooked in that food, if it was not cooked for non-kosher food in 24 hours, meaning if it was over 24 hours ago, the food is still kosher. You shouldn't do it, but the food's still good. Because whatever would have been absorbed, that's exuded would be noten ta'am lifgam, would impart a negative flavor, and therefore is not going to be considered halachically significant. Yeah. There again, this is not something that many people will tell people to do. Mm-hmm. This is at least Rambam, but I want to use this to try to illustrate why this would work. In terms of the assumption that if something is noten ta'am lifgam, if something imparts a negative taste to something else, we are not concerned with anything that might have been absorbed, right? As a matter of imparting taste. Now, this does not mean if you eat non-kosher food that you don't like, you're okay, right? Like, let's say, like, I don't like lobster or whatever, right? I don't like the taste of lobster. That doesn't mean you're allowed to eat lobster because it's noten ta'am lifgam. It gives over a bad taste. That's not how this works. This is specifically referring to stuff that's been absorbed by the walls. right, of a vessel and how that can get exuded.
It's so interesting, I think, that, okay, so Rambam here is saying that, you know, in a worst-case scenario, if accidents happen or whatnot, if it was 24 hours old, then it's okay to, you know, still eat that food. Mm,
no, well, it's okay to eat.
Always.
No, he's saying there's a rabbinic decree against it, meaning right. You shouldn't do it.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Right, but were it done, the food is still okay.
Right, that's what I meant. So were it done, the food is still okay, and obviously that's controversial. Some would say, yeah, some would agree, some would not agree. But with the 160th thing, which is actually meat in unkosher, something that's actually in the meat, everyone says that's okay?
No. So that was, again, going back to that, thank you for bringing that up. The language of the Gemara here is, umin bimino deleka lemekam ata'ame, where it's impossible to discern, like, the flavor there. If you know that it's there, you take it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Doesn't mean you can just leave it there. We're talking about a situation where you can't. Right? So if, like, a small piece of meat fell into a giant vat of milk, right, you fish it out. Right? You don't just leave it there.
Right.
So thank you for bringing that up for clarification purposes. When you can remove it, you do remove it. It's not always that simple. Right? If it's a liquid that falls into your liquid crock pot, you're not getting that out so easy.
Right. But and so people would still say that if it's less than 160th, that it's permissible to still eat that.
Assuming it can't be tasted.
Right. Assuming it can't be tasted. I would think that would the opposite, right? Wouldn't it be like that? That sounds like it should be less okay.
Because you're actually, so again, this is where ta'am ki ikar fits in. The taste is right, like everything else. If you can't taste it, it's not going to be halachically there, provided, I mean, it's an I don't know exactly how they came up with 1/60 for taste dilution. I don't know. Right. But a great point there too. But the assumption is 1/60, right. it's quite a lot there. You know, trying to multiply out, so like if you got like 1 teaspoon, like 60 teaspoons is quite a lot comparatively.
Oh, it is, yeah, sure.
Proportionally, like especially if you're talking about like a substantive piece of meat falling into a cholent, you need a really large crock pot. Which, you know, the largest type of things I've seen like that happen to have been in Israel. Everyone's been like in Israel, like one of those industrial school type kitchens. It's like really a giant vat, like a massive cauldron, where the way they scoop stuff out, and whatever. You should see those. It's anyway.
I remember learning about the 160th rule in elementary school, and the example that my rabbi gave was that if, you know, someone's mom is like cooking a big thing of chicken soup, and like a kid is like leaning over to see the chicken soup, is like eating ice cream, and a little drop of ice cream falls in.
Yeah,
then that's like a little drop of ice cream in a big old chicken soup.
How does that happen?
It was an example.
You don't have kids yet.
I've heard crazier things.
Yeah. Sam, you had a question.
I guess, so the 160th rule doesn't apply to meat and dairy?
The 160th rule technically could apply to meat and dairy, but that's a whole separate... Yeah, we're not getting up to details yet. Like a little piece of, like the example that Josh just gave, a little piece of your thing came in there about in terms of dilution, it gets complicated. Again, like, there are reasons why I'm evasive when it's, you know, for details to get the general principles across. Because these are the principles that come up the most, both in terms of how people screw up their kitchens or how they think they screwed up their kitchens but don't, and ways of, I would say, getting around stuff, but, like, why things are going to be the way they are.
I have a question.
Sure.
About the last source.
Yeah.
I don't really understand. It means food that went bad?
It's not food that went bad. It's when we're concerned now with taste that was absorbed by the vessel, or let's say the pot. So let's say it's a clay pot, so we still cook something in. We're concerned that with the taste that was absorbed, because if it's non-kosher taste that was absorbed by the pot, then that pot, once you use it, is going to push that non-kosher food taste right back into it. And since ta'am ki ikar, taste is like the real thing, it's as if you're eating non-kosher food. But following the principle of notein ta'am lifgam, if something imparts a negative flavor, it's considered as if it doesn't impart anything. And a premise two, that any food that was stored within, any taste, I should say, that was stored within the walls of the clay pot, after 24 hours goes bad, then we put those two things together and say, well, after 24 hours, any residual taste that's in that clay pot is going to impart a negative flavor, so and therefore we don't need to care about it.
Food has to have gone bad in the vessel.
It's not the food that gone bad, it's the residual taste of the food goes bad after 24 hours.
So like mold grew on your tomato sauce or something.
Well, we're not concerned with the actual, that's like, the food, the mamashut itself.
Right.
We're talking again specifically about stuff in the taste that was absorbed. So if you, let's say, had a pot, you washed it out completely and there's nothing residual there at all, like no mamashut, no actual gunk stuck to the side, right? You're talking just about the taste that was absorbed. If you've got like the non-kosher stuff gunked on the side, you're not worried about the taste of it, you're worried about it because it's there. Right? And that's why I said that thing is like, it doesn't always apply like, well, you know, I don't like lobster and I don't like the taste and therefore it doesn't work. Like, that's why I gave that example there. There's a difference here between mamashut, which is the actual thing of something, right, from the word mamash, versus any taste that was absorbed by it. So, I mean, this crock pot is nominally white. There are some other colorations here, but you put your hand through it, there's nothing actually in here, right? But let's say this is like right after Shabbos. After Shabbos, unless you use one of those bag things, you've got gunk stuck to the side of your crock pot. That gunk is called mamashut. Right, that's something that's actual, that's something that's real. Even if I wash out my crock pot beautifully, right, and get it spick and span, that it, you see absolutely nothing but the original color, the taste that's absorbed is still going to be there, right, even if the mamashut isn't. It's just after 24 hours, whatever taste that was absorbed, the ta'am, is considered to go bad.
The ta'am.
The ta'am is what goes bad, yes.
So you shouldn't cook milk meal in a meat dish 24 hours after you've had meat in it, but if you did, it would still be kosher.
That is a question that I am avoiding intentionally.
Okay.
I was just trying to define what negative flavor is. That doesn't seem like an objective.
True. Well, so it's a great question that you raise. What does it mean to impart a negative flavor? So there are two things. So one, I mean, food does go bad. It goes spoiled. It gets rancid. Here you're talking about, even though it's not objective, does it, doesn't, we could argue how much objectivity is there about taste being absorbed by the walls of a pot, right? Again, halachic physics, that at least here we have an objective metric by which to evaluate. There are times when it can happen. So here was something that I learned also when I was in NYU. We had a special guest speaker. I don't want to mention the name, but less, you know, gets blamed for it. It was about a question that comes up a lot regarding sherry casks and whiskey. Right, so you come to our scotch, you know, menu, we serve scotch after, you know, Kabbalat Shabbat here, really nice, and the question comes up because there are a whole bunch of details when it comes to distilling liquor, or not distilling, but like fermenting, or whatever the term is, brewing, a better word, scotch. And a lot of the flavor comes from the specific types of barrels that they get. So, for example, some scotches will only get barrels from a particular distributor in the world that they use to brew their stuff, right? Because they like the wood, right? Like we said, the ta'am, right? The taste gets absorbed by the wood, right? So then you brew stuff in there and that flavor comes right out. So the question comes up, what about sherry casks? Right, so let's say you've got casks of wine that were used for sherry, and that's specifically because it is. You've got casks that were used for fermenting sherry wine for a long time. Those casks are then reused or recycled for various scotches. But now you got yourself a problem. Because if that sherry wine wasn't kosher, you now have your scotch that is flavored by non-kosher wine.
Right?
And you can't say that it's not tasteable, because the whole reason why you're doing it is for the taste. It's like one reason why we get concerned over artificial flavors or natural flavors. Why do they have to be kosher? Even if it's a trace amount, you taste it. Because if you didn't taste it, they wouldn't put in the flavors. Right? They're there to flavor the thing. So even if it's a small amount, it's like, oh, natural flavor, you know, artificial flavors, you don't need to care. Yes, you do need to care. Right? Because you taste them. No bato b'shishim. You see how they all come together? Right? So the question came up, so how are you allowed to drink from these alcohols that are infused with sherry wine, or the taste of sherry wine?
You're not heating them, though, right?
Doesn't matter, because the taste still comes out. Usually the transference is done through heat, right? But here, I mean, you're still tasting non-kosher wine.
The cow has the gharif.
I don't know about skimming the chari thing. The answer that I got, at least from the class, was as follows. That what the sherry does is, the reason why they use these sherry casks isn't because of the sherry. It's because they want the taste of the wood. Meaning certain wood is going to impart certain flavor to the alcohol too. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, the taste of the wood would be far too strong and overwhelming. So why do they use sherry casks? Because the sherry mutes the strong taste of the wood. So what does that mean by halacha? Because since the sherry is notein ta'am lifgam, it actually negates a bit, provides a negative taste towards the flavor of the wood, we don't care about the taste of the sherry. This is how it was explained to me. Do with that as you see fit. Right? But that's where you have, going back to your point, about notein ta'am lifgam in action in a way that you might not expect it.
Yeah,
that it's the sherry that mutes the taste of the wood, right? So then it is notein ta'am lifgam. All right? So for those who drink from sherry casks, that's at least one basis for it. All right, so next week we're going to get into more practical examples. Keep it all posted. We'll probably announce in shul whether or not we do it in someone's apartment, because we'll see if that makes things more easier or more complicated. All right? If we can do it here, if we can't, I'll just bring in some props.
Okay.
All right, excellent. Have a wonderful week.